Well, welcome to Michiana Adventist Forum. Our program today is about attitudes toward intimate partner violence among Seventh-day Adventists, an interplay of sex and religion. Our presenter is Julia Pickett. Following her presentation, Gary Gray will, as usual, coordinate a discussion. Today we have some panelists who are professionals in the area having to do with various aspects of family life, and they'll be available to ask questions, answer questions, make comments along with our speaker, Dr. Anne Marie Jones from the School of Social Work, Attorney Janelle Harris, who practices family law in St. Joseph, Dr. Nancy Carbonell from the Department of Educational and Counseling Psychology, and what I am usually referred to as our token male here, where we have Rick Kaczynski. So we have a little bit of male perspective thrown in here. So thank you for all of you for participating. As we begin, Bob Johnson is going to offer a word of prayer.
Heavenly Father, we thank thee that in this dry place we can gather and be stimulated and encouraged and instructed and rebuked as each of us needs by what is going to be presented this afternoon. I pray that thy hand may be upon their mouths, that they may say what we need to hear. For Jesus' sake, amen.
Thank you. Our next forum program is May 2. Dr. Larry Garrity, who I'm sure many of you know, the recently retired president of La Sierra University and a well-known archaeologist, is going to present a program entitled My Most Interesting Archaeological Discoveries Relating to the Bible. So that's actually graduation weekend, and that's why we were able to get him, because he's going to be here to receive, I think, an honorary degree from the university when he's consenting to speak to us in the afternoon. So we invite you to, if you're not tied up with something else on graduation weekend, to come and hear Dr. Garrity. I just mentioned that this is the 40th anniversary year for Adventist Forums, and the National Association of Adventist Forums is planning a weekend to commemorate this out in Pacific Grove, California. It's the weekend of November 6 to 8 in the fall, so if any of you have an interest or out that way, I'm sure it'll be a stimulating weekend. And as usual, we're appreciative to those who have helped to publicize and make our program work, Terry Calkins, Debbie Robertson on the publicity, and Jim Harris on the audio and on the website. And I would remind you that if you would like to get on the email list, there are some sign-up sheets in the back. And if you would like to look at our website, which has recordings of any of our programs that can be downloaded, along with some other material, go to www.michianaadventistforum.org. Is it net or is it com? org. Okay. So we thank you. Well, as I say, our presentation today is about attitudes toward intimate partner violence in the Adventist community, and the research on this was specifically done here among Adventists in the Berrien Springs and Andrews University campus communities. So it's a topic that's fairly close home. Julia Pickett was formerly a student here, now as an alumnus, and she was involved in this research when she was on campus, actually made a presentation of some of this a couple of years ago at an honors symposium or whatever, and we heard some really great reports on what it was, so we've been trying to get her back. Couldn't get her last year because she was down studying, doing some postgraduate work in Argentina. One of her fields is Spanish, so for obvious reasons, that was a great place to pursue that. Well, we'll turn the time over to you, and we're looking forward to it, and thank you for coming up from Bloomington for this.
Okay, can you hear me? Everybody hear me? It's on. Okay, great. I will make one little correction. It's not postgraduate work. I was finishing up my undergraduate work in Argentina. And actually, when Gary first emailed me about this presentation, he said, Julia, we need to talk about your honors project. And I wrote back and I said, there must be a mistake. I already finished my project. And I didn't realize I'd be invited to speak, so I consider this a real privilege, and I'm very happy and excited to present this material. Let me go ahead and get this set up. Of course, this was research done for my honors project, and you may be asking, okay, whose attitudes are we talking about here? Often we hear about the attitudes of the victim or the attitudes of the perpetrator involved in an abusive situation. But we need to remember that there are third parties always involved. And in this case, we're particularly looking at religious leaders or fellow Christians of the couple that is having intimate partner violence. Studies have shown that clergy are often the first to hear about an abusive situation. A victim will often first go to a clergy member before they go to someone else. And other studies have shown that informal support networks, such as the church, play a significant role for victims and abusers. The reason we're looking at attitudes is because our attitudes influence our behavior. Our attitudes will ultimately determine our response to an abusive situation. And when we're talking about intimate partner violence, it may determine whether or not there's intervention or lack of intervention. Attributions of blame. Who's to blame? Is it the perpetrator? Is it the victim? Is there blame going on for both of them? Criminalization of the violence. The victim's decision to leave or seek shelter is very important. We'll talk a little bit about that. And then, of course, victim recovery. And the reason I mention that is if the victim believes that they are to blame or other people tell them they are to blame, the recovery is going to be much more difficult and complicated. I would love to present a lot of the research that's out there, but I don't have time to do that. And this diagram is from a study that was done in 2000, and I feel that it really summarizes what is out there. You can see here, coming from the church community, what research has found is that there are common reactions to an abusive situation. One of them is spiritualization of the problem. This is something, a common thing that research has found. Also, gender role perceptions. I don't know if you can see my little red dot there. Gender role perceptions influence the church's response to abuse. For a common example would be that women should be submissive to males. But in the case of an abusive situation, that gets much more complicated. And then, of course, denial and minimization. And this is not only for domestic violence, but other forms of abuse. And the result of that is that the victim feels more guilt and self-blame and may go into isolation and alienation in relationship to their church community. Over on the other side here, in relationship to, well, should there be a divorce or should the couple separate, the church community has been found to be very resistant to divorce, and we believe that marriage is sacred, so that's understandable. Another thing is conditional support, and what they mean here is that when the problem rises up, people in the Christian community have been found to withdraw from the situation rather than go in and offer that extra support that's really needed at that time. And then blaming the victim, just blatantly blaming the victim for the abuse. Of course, this makes it more difficult. And in this particular study, the researchers found that women who were experiencing domestic violence, when they made the decision to get out of the abusive situation, they felt that they were actually going against what they had been taught was right. So they had to, in their minds, shut off the information and the advice that they were given from people in the religious community around them in order to do what they needed to protect themselves and to get the help that they needed. So a big summary of the research, there's a lot more detail there, is just that community attitudes or informal social norms have a significant impact on three main areas. One is the definition of abuse, which is kind of the foundation for deciding how to deal with it, if people really think it's abuse, attributions of blame, and finally, the solutions that are offered to the victims. And in the case of this particular study, this means that if members of the Adventist community either ignore or minimize abuse, or they're indirectly supporting it with unhealthy attitudes, abuse is likely to continue among its members. The purpose of the current studies was to understand common attitudes in this community about intimate partner violence. And the data that I looked at was specifically narrowed down to respondents who marked that they were both baptized and practicing Seventh-day Adventists. And we also wanted to understand how the religion of, or we should say even spirituality, the self, self-rated spirituality of the respondents and then their sex would influence their attitudes. And I'll explain that a little bit more. The data was actually gathered by Dr. Marciana Popescu and Jan Wren. The survey was called Strengthening Adventist Survey. It was mailed out to Berrien Springs, to graduate housing, and surveys were done in classes on the campus of Andrews. We had 550 surveys that were completed. What I did was take just a small part of the survey and look at it. There were actually 11, they weren't really statements. They weren't really questions, they were statements. And I categorized them into three areas. One was definition of abuse. How did the respondents rate the seriousness of domestic violence in their community of faith as a social problem? And then finally, what would they do in response, their solutions and their attributions of blame? We used cross-tabulations, Kendall-Taube, and the Pearson chi-square. So again, the most interesting results were in the area of the sex of the respondent and their self-reported adherence to Seventh-day Adventist doctrine. The first set I'm going to look at here is limited not by sex at all, just limited to, limited by sex of the respondents, and we tried to find out how that would influence their attitudes. So I wanted to have a list of the statements for you, but I couldn't get to a printer in time. But this is one of the statements that was on the survey. Abuse only occurs if physical violence happens. We had 66.5% of women and 51.2% of males strongly agree with the statement. This was, you can see the statistical significance there. Our conclusion here is that women are more likely than men to strongly agree. On the second statement, emotional abuse can be just as harmful as physical abuse. Women are much more likely than males to strongly agree. Only 54% of males strongly agreed with that statement. Then we looked at the sex of the respondent and these other three statements. Domestic abuse is a serious problem affecting family wellness in general. And we found that women, again, are much more likely than men to strongly agree with this statement. Only 65% of males strongly agree with that, but statistically, women are much more likely than men to strongly agree with that. The same with the next statement, domestic abuse is a serious problem in the Adventist church. Other studies have been done that found that domestic violence is a problem in the Seventh-day Adventist community, but what we found is that women seem to have a more realistic estimate of this in the Adventist community. Oh, in this particular study, women are more likely than men to strongly agree. And finally, the severity of abuse has been exaggerated by the women's movement. Not surprisingly, women are more likely to strongly disagree with this statement than men. Only 15% of men strongly disagreed with this. For the statement, if women would submit to their husbands as God desires, there would be less abuse. This one is very strong statistical significance. Females are much more likely to strongly agree with this statement. are much more, I'm sorry, I think I have a mistake there. If women would submit to their husbands as God desires, there would be less abuse. Females are much more likely to strongly disagree than males. I'm sorry, I mistyped there. And with the next statement, if a woman submits to her husband, God will give her the strength to endure. Again, females are much more likely to strongly disagree than males. Males are actually pretty neutral on that statement. As a Christian, I should be willing to accept a marriage with some violence. Females are, again, I mean, I'm sounding repetitive at this point. Females are much more likely than men to strongly disagree with this statement. And men, interestingly, were very neutral on this. They're more likely to be neutral than women. The same for the next one. If a couple goes to counseling, the abuse will likely stop. Women were not so sure about this. They're more likely to strongly disagree with this statement than men. And males are neutral. So in summarizing this first section, I think it's safe to say that women more strongly disagree with negative statements, which is consistent with other research. And it is likely that negative attitudes in the Seventh-day Adventist Church about this topic are being driven by males rather than females, or more likely driven by males. Now we're going to look at how the respondents rated themselves on a scale. They were asked, do you consider yourself to conservatively, very conservatively, or liberally adhere to the doctrines of your church? So we've sorted the data based on this. Again, this is limited to baptized practicing Seventh-day Adventists. It may be a little hard to see there. On this side, we have strongly disagree. And on that side, we have strongly agree. If women would submit to their husbands, there would be less spouse abuse. So we have nearly 40% of very conservatives either agreed or strongly agreed with this statement. It's almost half. Liberals, nearly 80% disagreed or strongly disagreed with this statement. The conclusion here, the assumption that I'm making here is that to agree with this statement is to simultaneously blame the victim. If you believe that the woman can actually stop her own abuse by submitting to her abusive husband. So my conclusion here is that those who believe that they conservatively adhere to Seventh-day Adventist doctrine are significantly more likely to blame the victim. Now we have, if women would submit, God would give them strength to endure the abuse. We have a similar pattern here. And you can see there's... Actually, and I just want to point out that we still have the majority of people disagreeing with this statement. But what we're looking at is that for those who did agree, they're much more likely to consider themselves very conservative Adventists. That's a very consistent and strong pattern on all of these questions. Again, liberals are very unlikely to agree, very likely to disagree with this. So the conclusion here is that those who believe they more conservatively adhere to Seventh-day Adventist doctrine are significantly more likely to believe that women should continue to submit despite abuse. As a Christian, I should be willing to accept a marriage with some violence. Actually, this was interesting that both... Again, we're not dividing this by the sex of the respondent. So both men and women are significantly more likely to strongly agree with this statement if they are conservative, if they consider themselves conservative. And then liberals, again, are more likely to reject an abusive relationship is the conclusion that I'm coming to from this. And finally, in this section, the last one I looked at is the Bible is the answer to all problems, to all human problems. Now, I personally don't fully disagree with this statement myself. This is a very complicated issue, and I don't pretend to be an expert or a theologian, and I don't intend to get into this, but just try to remember that this is in the context of all these other statements, and they were listed back-to-back in the survey. So for someone who is conservative, what we've seen in the other slides, those people are much more likely statistically to blame the victim or accept these other negative attitudes. The same people are likely to strongly agree with the statement in the context of all those other statements. So that was the concern there. Now we're going to look at adherence to doctrine and their attitudes, and we're going to separate them between men and women. For this statement that we've looked at before, if women would submit, there would be less abuse. The interesting thing here is that for women, again, we still have the majority that are disagreeing with the statement, but generally speaking, women disagreed with the statement. We didn't have a real strong statistical result here. You can see that right here. But not as strong as some of the other ones. But this is different for men, and I will show you what I mean when we look at the men's results. As a Christian, I should be willing to accept a marriage with some violence. liberal women are more likely to strongly disagree with the statement. You can see that spike right there of the light brown on strongly disagree. And 90% of liberal women disagreed or strongly disagreed with the statement. Among conservatives and very conservatives, they are more likely to be neutral. So there's not as strong of a pattern as we saw. We'll see with the men. The Bible is the answer to all problems. Very conservative and conservative women are much more likely than liberals to strongly agree with the statement. And liberals are more likely to strongly disagree. There are no very conservative women who strongly disagree with the statement. So that was interesting. Now we're going to look at men and see how that's different. Here we have, if women would submit, there would be less abuse. Very conservative men are much more likely to strongly agree or agree than liberals. 21% of the respondents strongly agreed with the statement. So the conclusion here is that very conservative men are significantly more likely to blame women victims for their abuse. My question is, I don't know this, but it would be very interesting to find out of these respondents, how many of them are in leadership positions. And from what we saw earlier, if a woman is likely to go to clergy first as a resource, would it be these people that she's talking to? Again, we still have a lot of very conservative people disagreeing with this statement, but of those that agreed, they're more likely to be very conservative. If women would submit, God would give them strength to endure the abuse. Again, very conservative men are more likely to agree than conservatives or liberals. And this statement, we're assuming, means that women should submit despite the abuse. I mean, it's not difficult to see there. 17.2% of very conservatives strongly agreed with the statement. Only 4.8% of conservatives strongly agreed. Only 4.2% of liberals. So we see this big swing for the very conservative men. As a Christian, I should be willing to accept a marriage with some violence. Only very conservative and conservative men strongly agree with the statement. And very conservative men are less likely to disagree. I'm being very repetitive because the results are very consistent. We're almost done here. The Bible is the answer to all problems, all human problems. Again, liberal men are more likely to disagree than conservatives. 31.3% of liberals disagreed. Only 3.4% of very conservative disagree. Now this is a more complicated statement here. I don't think it's black and white, really. But the strongest agreement was among very conservative men, 58.6% of them. Strongly agreed. So the findings, we can conclude here from the findings of this study. First of all, there are unhealthy attitudes among baptized Seventh-day Adventist members in this community. Now, why? Why is that? Across all categories, some Adventists are strongly agreeing with dangerous statements. I'd like it if there were none, but they're there. Significant gender differences exist. This is very interesting. One of the most interesting findings in this study. Women are more strongly disagreeing with these unhealthy attitudes. Conservative women and men. So let's say that there's a man who is in an abusive relationship, he also is more likely to stay in an abusive relationship or encourage others to stay in an abusive relationship. Conservative men and women are likely to blame female victims for their abuse. Conservative men and women, I should actually change that and say conservative men and women are more likely than liberal Seventh-day Adventists to blame female victims for their abuse. And then finally, conservative men and women are likely to see the Bible as their main source. And that may also mean that they see the church as their main social resource for help. And therefore, my conclusion is that if this is true, victims in the Seventh-day Adventist church may not find the support that they need. Because if, in fact, there are leaders or even lay members in the church who are being sought for help, and they are accepting these kind of attitudes, they may not get the help that they need in that very serious situation. I looked quickly on the website that has a statement of abuse about statement on abuse and family violence, an official statement from the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And if you don't mind, I'd like to just read through it briefly, because I think we would be surprised to find that the church would support any of these ideas. So it's interesting to see the difference here. The Seventh-day Adventist Church says that we affirm the dignity and worth of each human being and decry all forms of physical, sexual, and emotional abuse and family violence. I pulled this right off the website. We recognize the global extent of this problem and the serious long-term effects upon the lives of all involved. We believe that Christians must respond to abuse and family violence both within the church and in the community. We take seriously reports of all abuse and violence and have highlighted these issues for discussion at this international assembly. This is from the General Conference in 1995, and this study was done about 10 years later. We believe that to remain indifferent and unresponsive is to condone, perpetuate, and potentially extend such behavior. This sounds great. It really is. I'm in agreement with this 100%. We accept our responsibility to cooperate with other professional services, to listen and care for those suffering from abuse and family violence, to highlight the injustices, and to speak out in defense of victims. That's a very important point. We will help persons in need to identify and access a range of available professional services. When changed attitudes and behavior open possibilities for forgiveness and new beginnings, we will provide a ministry of reconciliation. We will assist families in grief over relationships that cannot be restored. So there is a possibility of not restoring those relationships. It's recognized that that is a possibility. We will address the spiritual questions confronting abused persons seeking to understand the origins of abuse and family violence and develop better ways of preventing the recurring cycle. So this statement really addresses a lot of what was in the survey, but we see some inconsistencies. They're saying that we publicly denounce family violence. The church recognizes it as a serious social problem. Not all of our respondents even recognize that it's a serious social problem. To remain silent is to condone or perpetuate abuse. Defending victims. Again, we saw some people who would have blamed the victim. Seeking other professional services, that means that the church is not the only resource. The possibility of irreconcilable relationships. And finally, the church wants to seek ways to better prevent abuse from even occurring. It's getting a little... There we go. Caught up with me. I would recommend from the findings of this study, I have some ideas for what the church could do. One is in-depth training of pastors. I know we have a wonderful seminary, and I know that they do talk about these issues, but perhaps it could be dealt with a little bit more in-depth, because pastors are the primary source for dealing with these issues among church members. Wouldn't it be great if we could have this topic discussed and studied in the Sabbath School quarterlies? I think we're sometimes afraid of dealing with these social problems, and it would do us well to study in depth this topic because it's out there. Also, local conference seminars on the issue. Small groups build relationships. They provide accountability, and that's where change can happen. Local marriage enrichment programs, I personally have enjoyed Boundaries of Marriage by Cloud and Townsend. This is something that my husband and I have been using at our home church. Where we go, this is the book that we're using, and it's affordable and very biblically sound and really addresses some of these issues. And, of course, premarital counseling. Some of the weaknesses of this study were that the survey really could have used some better wording, and the perspective of the researchers may have been implied. Many of the statements were pretty strong and pretty obvious. I think that if I were taking this survey, I would have kind of known where the surveyors were coming from. So that's some of the weaknesses. There were a few positive statements offered, so maybe we could have provided more positive statements for people to respond to. We could have had variations of the same statements to see if people caught the differences. And then self-reported adherence to doctrine is very subjective, so there's a lot of variation in that, and that's hard to measure. And I just wanted to say here that, but despite these weaknesses, the results were significant and consistent. And the results were also consistent with literature. So. This is dedicated to my mother. She died as a result of domestic violence. And I want to thank Dr. Marciana Popescu and Dr. Carla Bailey and Jan Wren. Thank you for coming today.
We'll ask our panel to come up and while you're thinking of questions. Yeah, if you... Is it cold? Oh, so. I think you know most of these people, Professors Rick Kaczynski, Nancy Carbonell, Anne Marie Jones, and Attorney Janelle Harris. So, can you get some lights? Okay, questions, reactions, comments?
At the beginning, it looked like you. One of the things you studied was the definition of abuse, but you didn't share with us what you define. I think physical violence is probably clear enough, but emotional abuse, would that include nagging? Or and second, did you find that maybe men have a higher pain tolerance than women do?
One of the statements, I'm sorry, I didn't know how to fix the light, so. One of the statements was abuse only occurs if physical violence happens. And that was one of the statements that relates to the definition of abuse, because we all know that abuse goes way beyond physical violence into emotional abuse and other forms of abuse. So that was what I was referring to, was that statement. Well, that would be complicated. But I personally believe that emotional abuse is demeaning and putting a person down, being disrespectful in a consistent, severe pattern of behavior. That's my personal definition.
I just got wished Merry Christmas. Before I came over here, I printed off the internet some of this stuff. Michigan.gov has a lot of information on domestic violence, if anyone cares to Google it, both in terms of the definitions that are generally accepted by law enforcement as well as the social services industry. And it also has a mandated reporter's resource guide, which is really very interesting and informative. But the definition that they wrote for emotional and psychological abuse has threatened harm to you, your family, or your pets, beliefs, race, heritage, class, religion, or sexual orientation, being ridiculed, manipulated with lies and contradictions, being convinced you are to blame for the abuse, being stalked, It also talks about other kinds of abuse, such as physical abuse, sexual abuse, economic abuse.
Did that answer your question, sir? Okay, I'll just add my two cents, and we'll put it in some simplistic terms that I have come to find. And you mentioned nagging. Depending on how it's done, that could be a form of emotional abuse. But what we're really talking about, name-calling, calling someone stupid, fat, ugly, worthless, hopeless, meaningless, talking about someone's hair. And the thing you have to remember, what you mentioned, the word consistent. Now, if I put on a pink and green dress with polka dots and my husband said, that's ugly, and I only wore it once, well, I would not consider that emotional abuse because, one, I only wore it once and he said it once and we were done with it. But if everything that I put on was ugly, I was ugly in everything I did, if everything that I said was meaningless, if I was not allowed over a period of time to state my opinion, to be validated on anything that I said, and this happened on a consistent basis, then we're dealing with emotional abuse. Anything that demeans, belittles, as she said, disrespects the woman, to make the perpetrator, be it male or female, I should say, the man or the woman, to make the perpetrator feel better about him or herself, or to give more power to the perpetrator, that's what we're considering emotional abuse. Thank you, sir.
Frequently it's a control issue.
Yeah, I that's exactly what I was going to say, so she did it even better. And I think part of the issue is, as couples, being sensitive to what our spouses perceive as demeaning and destructive to their being. And so sometimes, you know, it's even hard to say exactly what might be abusive to each person because of our background, our sensitivities, our temperaments, our personalities. So, you know, part of educating each other as to tuning into what our partners are perceiving, and if our partner says, whether it's male or female, I'm feeling abused, that should perk up our ears, whatever it is, and so we can explore it better with our partner.
We have a question. Oh, go ahead.
Just to piggyback on what she said, she mentioned culture. And my thought to culture is, whether I have come from Zimbabwe or China, stupid is stupid. If you're calling me stupid, it doesn't matter where I'm coming from. Stupid is not a positive word in any sense of the way. I mean, there are people, of course, who joke about it with, oh, you're so stupid. Yeah, and it doesn't mean much, but we're talking about consistent negativity. And when you're saying stupid, it doesn't matter what country I've come from, I'm going to take it in a negative way. But what she said is so beautiful, that if you are hearing me say, I'm feeling abused or I'm feeling diminished or disrespected, the ears need to perk up to say, oh, that's something I shouldn't say to my spouse or my intimate partner. That's something that is going to make this person hurt.
In this this survey was done in this community. It's interesting that this Andrew's community is a fairly international community. And so you have cultures, and I don't know much about this topic, but have a different approach to marriage relations. And I wondered how that affects Julia's results, and you just spoke to them. Any of you like to talk more about the cultural differences within this community and within the world?
I don't know if I want to talk so much about that. I think cultural differences, stupid is stupid. I mean, if people, I think for, as Christians, the thing that should guide our behavior is the golden rule. Treat other people as we would want to be treated. That would be the essential thing. But I was curious about how you defined very conservative, and liberal, and then you had an N of 550 in your original study, and approximately how did that break down? Okay, that's okay. I was just curious about it because it would be interesting to know how because that's a really important part of your study, is identifying people who can say they were very conservative and then liberal.
I don't know if I was clear about that part, but this is the way they rated themselves. So they marked that on the survey. And that was why I mentioned at the end that that's subjective. And, you know, you may say, well, you're very, you know, I'm very liberal. And I may look at you and say, well, no, you're not. You're very conservative. So that's very subjective. But this was the way that they rated themselves and what they believed to be true. And I thought, and also on the cultural issue, I really wish, and I should go back and study the data according to culture or country of origin, because I think we would see some patterns there as well. But what was interesting was, despite that, there was just consistent patterns. Mm. So even if you're coming from China and you consider yourself very conservative, the patterns were similar if you're from America and you consider yourself very conservative.
Okay, we have a question back here.
I don't think your survey addressed it, but it would be very interesting to know how educational level would affect the attitudes, because that has huge implications then for whether we have to be afraid, just as afraid about church leadership, pastors, and so on.
Well, actually, I'm going to add to my dear sister's study. I did my own study, and we discussed educational levels as well as religious aspects and religious levels. And it was ironic in my study that we found out the more educated you were, the less open-minded you were, the less likely you were to admit that me calling you stupid is violence, is abuse. The more money you made, the less concerned you were about this. And that was a shock to my system, and I was like, no, don't say that. But the more educated some people are, you ever heard the more educated you are, the stupider you get? Unfortunately, some people it applies, because I have so much education that I've lost my sense of right and wrong, because I'm so educated that I think I'm above everyone else for one thing, and I think you can't tell me anything else for two. So the more education I found in my own survey, the more people were willing to accept certain things. And back to the culture issue, that people adhere to different things, and I had to write it down before I forget. Abraham had two wives. That didn't mean it was right. It's just what was accepted, and even accepted by God, but not condoned by God. We have many things in our society today that's accepted, not necessarily right. And especially in an Adventist community, we have to do what's right more so than what's accepted.
Yeah, and the Bible accepts slavery, and we don't anymore. Question over here.
When you look at, I heard you mention religious, maybe a religious abuse. Was that mentioned? I don't remember.
Yes.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll make up my own question too.
There is such a thing.
Okay. When
especially
I think
in this
of,
community.
When I think of myself, I'm in a relationship with someone who came from a non-Seventh-day Adventist background. And kind of came into the Adventist faith. And so certain things that I thought of as, hey, this is how I've lived all my life, you know, she might consider, hey, you know, this is like you're trying to force your religion on me. And the term abuse came out one time, and I was like, whoa, you know, that's pretty serious, you know, to hear that. You know, it's kinda and I was shocked by that, but I never realized that. How would you address an issue like that?
It's really easy. It's pulling the God card to control someone else. Playing Holy Spirit, the spiritual abuse. I think it's really easy to define. And some of us have had a lot of experience with it. So,
you know, part of the dynamic here is a lack of self-awareness. And so that a statement like that, it should say to you, whoa, how is she getting that impression? And what am I doing to contribute to that? And it's spending time developing a self-awareness that is important. And, you know, when you were saying to educate ministers, I think there's a large component that's missing in their training to develop a self-awareness. And so they totally miss things that are right in front of their faces because they're not tuned into to themselves.
I wouldn't say that. Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
We have a question.
Well, I like this idea that was referred to, that the Bible has the answer to all our problems. I read in the creation story of Genesis that God created human beings in his image. And this statement, to me, has profound ethical implications. One of which is that all human beings must be treated not only with respect, but also with sensitivity. And this idea of treating human beings with sensitivity is reinforced by the biblical statement that people are to love their neighbors as they love themselves. So I believe the time has come for our young people to be taught in their homes, in their schools, and in churches that all human beings must be treated with respect and sensitivity. And if they are, I would expect to see the incidence of abuse of any kind to decline dramatically.
Amen. I agree with this, what the gentleman just said, and the Bible does have the answers to all of our problems. Within the Bible, it tells us to seek wise counsel. And that can also help some of the problems that we're having. Back to this gentleman and the religious abuse. Thank you for labeling it. It has been labeled already, though. But the beauty of relationships is learning to communicate. And part of communication is listening. And the fact that you heard her say abuse and it piqued something, perked something up in your mind, awesome. Wonderful. That means you were actually listening, and now you want to do something to make it better. It doesn't say you have to split up. It just means you want to find a good solution to that problem. And that's a beautiful thing, because most of the times, even though the Bible says that divorce can be entered into because of adultery, it doesn't actually mean you have to get a divorce. It doesn't mean that. If the two people are willing to work at it, when you mentioned if they seek counseling, the abuse will stop, that may not be absolutely true. But if they attempt counseling and both are willing to have the abuse stop, then there is definitely a better chance of it stopping than only one pushing the other and then borderlining more abuse on the other part. It's just a whole cycle. But whether or not we are willing to listen to each other comes with communication. Abuse stems from not listening, from wanting to control the other person. It stems from not caring about the other person and not being sensitive to the other person's needs, wants, or wishes.
I just wanted to add something to the gentleman who just spoke, and that is, you know, the whole issue of getting educated as a community. As I was sitting there, I was thinking, I don't think I've ever heard a sermon on spousal abuse, ever. And I'm not 20 anymore. So, or 22. And so, And so, you know, and then another thing that struck me was how many neutrals there were. Because that's like they didn't really know. And some of those sentences, those comments, was like, whoa, you know. And for somebody to be so neutral, it was, you know, interesting. It says something about what we need to do as a community.
Yeah, is it possible that those who climb the social ladder or those who become more educated, that they do not admit to abuse, not necessarily because of their insensitivity to what they're experiencing, but based on their need to protect their image?
I think they're worried about their jobs in this community. I think it's very pragmatic. If you work for the university and your pastor works for the university, and your shrink works for the university, where do you go? I think this community is such a tight, closed community that it creates a lot of fear in seeking help. And then there's the whole social services end of this. If there is child abuse in the home, another form of domestic violence, and that child tells someone, and then you have community, the Child Protective Services coming in, your life is no longer your own. And the whole legal process is going to kick in, and you may end up being required to get a divorce. I mean, there's a lot of things that will be imposed on that family. And I think there's a great deal of fear that in a small community is exacerbated.
The other side of that coin is that the victims are afraid, and I hope I'm answering the right question, the victims are afraid to report the abuse because of what will happen on the other end of the phone or what will happen. I read a book once, and it was years ago, and I don't remember the author, and she was the wife of the city's mayor. And she called the domestic hotline number. And when they started to do the intake on her and found out her name and who she was married to, the woman, and she wanted to leave and go to the shelter. She was ready. And the woman at the shelter, and I apologize for shelters all around, she said to her, "Oh, you're the wife of the mayor. You must have money. You don't need the shelter. You can go to a hotel." So the fear of what I'll receive at the end of the other call or the when I go to my pastor, what the pastor will say, of course, is part of the surveys here. Oh, just go home and pray about it. Oh, just go home and be more submissive. So the fear, one, of losing the job, losing the respect of your community members, losing your house, your child, whatever the case may be, your life. On the other side of it is the fear of what you're going to say, how you're going to respond to me, because one, you may not believe me. Two, you think I have it all together because of the famous Adventist facade. And then three, you're not going to help me because you think I have it all together, and so I don't need the help. So there are many, many reasons why people don't report abuse. And unfortunately, especially in the Adventist community, I can especially say in Berrien Springs, in this very tight-knit, close community, we don't want to hear it, because that will say that our pastor is not perfect, that the deacon or the deaconess is not flawed, and that we'll actually then have to do something about it. And sometimes we don't want to touch it.
But it's not a secret. The courthouse knows. And I say that it is funny, but it is sad. Because when I walk in the courthouse and the bailiff says, "Hey, we had another one of you guys over here. He stole a six-pack of beer." They know our stuff, and they categorize it as being our stuff. We are perceived as a violent little secret community. And we have the unique capacity for being meaner and nastier in domestic situations than other people, because we bring God into it. And we play the God card fiercely with one another. I remember sitting in a deposition where the father was a Sabbath school superintendent in a local church, suing for custody of the party's son. And the reason he gave he gave me when I asked him that he thought he should have custody. Understand, the church bulletin was an exhibit, and the little Lutheran court reporter sitting there taking this all down, white-haired, white-eyed. And he said the reason was because the son was the reincarnation of his father. We have this strange cultural mix that plays into this, and it all gets laid out on the table, however it falls, before these judges. And I remember sitting there thinking, okay, the little Lutheran court reporter's hearing this, and now it's going to play for my Catholic judge. And I wanted to scream. We are taking all of our problems and all of our pain into very public forums to solve them, and keeping it very private when we're in town here. And I would desperately love to have us create a model of free, and it's going to have to be free because men won't pay for it, and I'm being sexist, but I've done this for 15 years, so don't shoot the messenger. It needs to be free conflict resolution with experts in different disciplines who will come in and help people if they need to uncouple, if they need to mend and heal. There isn't just one victim in these domestic violence situations. Hurting people hurt people. These men are hurting as well. They have deep wounds that are creating this desire to control. And so I think one of my burdens is that maybe when we've not just been asked to be on a panel, but that our church bring together some of us who work with these hurting people and brainstorm how we can solve the drama that's being played out at the courthouse so that it doesn't have to be quite, you know. But I'd rather have some transparency here and solve it here, or not alternatively, but additionally, have very quiet ways of solving it here for people where it's safe rather than the fun, frankly, that I get to do, the song and the dance, that is so destructive to families.
Just right before that thought, just when she mentioned it's out in the open, the courthouse knows it. I went to Oakwood College. Yay. The rumor was there's a Planned Parenthood in Birmingham that performs abortions, and they wanted to know why Oakwood College didn't have its own abortion clinic because so many students came down there. People know what's going on within our own communities, and so we have to stop trying to hide it and deal with it, be it abortion, be it domestic violence, be it alcoholism, drug abuse. People are aware. We're only humans, regardless of Adventism. We're humans, and we have problems, period.
Can I add something? I know I've been waiting for a while. But I really agree with what's being said here, and I think that there must be churches out there where openness and vulnerability are encouraged. And that in a church like that, I consider to be a safe place for growth. And that's why I mentioned in the presentation that I would really encourage small groups in local churches, because I personally have benefited from small groups. And to have a group of people where it's safe to open up about your struggles and to actually admit that you're having difficulties among fellow believers can be so helpful. But I just want to add that all the things we're talking about could be encouraged if the pastor were also making this a reasonable topic for a sermon, for example. If the pastor was modeling this and saying, you know, not trying to put on, you know, a front, and just admitting that these problems exist in our communities and inviting his members or her members to consider this from the pulpit, that could really start the ball rolling. A good example of this at our local church, we've been doing a marriage enrichment class on Sabbath afternoons. And I recently asked my pastor if the couples who participated could get up during Sabbath morning and share the things that we've been learning. And unfortunately that was not okay. We'll have to present it at another time. We're not able to do it during the worship service, but wouldn't it be wonderful if we could, and to get up there, be vulnerable and say, hey, I was struggling with this, and look, now this is where I am, and you can do that too.
Yeah, we have a question here.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could just elaborate on the problematic response that you mentioned earlier, that of spiritualizing the issue, spiritualizing the problem when it's presented to the church or to the pastor.
Well, the research that I was quoting was not our research. That was another research that was done. And I don't know exactly how they define spiritualizing. But I think a good example of that would be to say that
when there is an abusive situation, that the source for that abusive situation is a lack of spiritual discipline. That could be spiritualizing the problem. And that is very damaging, both to the victim and the perpetrator, because you can be a very sincere Christian, but the human experience is filled with problems. And so that's how I perceive spiritualizing a problem. I don't know exactly how those researchers had defined that.
I wonder if you could address the question of conservative and liberal. What makes conservatives answer the way they answered on this survey? And liberals answer the way they answered in this survey?
I can't answer that. I really wish I knew. And that it just really feeds my hunger for more information. I'm very curious as to why. What? Yeah, I'm speculating. I would love to. I don't know. But it's very subjective, and I don't know. But it's very, very interesting. Why do people who think that they are adhering to the official doctrines and practicing the doctrines of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, more people who believe that they do that more carefully, why are they in such contradiction with official statements of the church?
I want to touch on his before the other one. I think she has something to say. I don't mean to point it to you. Spiritualizing the problem mainly means blaming the victim. And usually in this case, we're talking about the female victim. And spiritualizing it means, one, did you pray about it? And two, let's go to Ephesians 5:20. That's usually where people send victims, is to Ephesians 5:20. And it goes back to what she talked about. If you were more submissive to your husband, then the abuse would stop. If you were more submissive, then none of this would happen. And blaming the victim. Spiritualizing it says that the Bible has all the answers and you're not, apparently not reading the Bible. And that has to do with the conservative liberal attitude as well, that I believe in the Bible. I believe in Ellen White, sometimes quote her more than the Bible, and therefore I am more conservative because you don't quote Ellen White as much as I do. So I'm more conservative, and I think that if you read the Bible more, prayed three times a day like Daniel did, then none of this would happen to you. That's along the lines of spiritualizing domestic violence. And again, it usually comes from the male to the female, and I don't mean the abuser, I mean in the church. If I go and say to someone, this is what is happening to me, then the spiritualizing begins. Did you pray about it? Did you read Ephesians 5:20? Did you read the Ten Commandments? Did you, whatever the case may be, and the Bible is brought to hit over the head with rather than to share with love.
And I think some of what might be missing so far are the characteristics of the perpetrator. And there are some characteristics that research shows across the board. One is they never think they've done anything wrong. And so it's always, if you wouldn't have yelled, if you wouldn't have said that, if you would have done this, then I wouldn't have slammed you up against the wall. I did it because I needed to put you in your place. And so because it's such a, it's an issue of power, when you start trying to intervene in these families, the abuser won't stop abusing unless somebody more powerful than them comes over them and says, you better not do that or we're putting you in jail. So in a way, you know, I'm sorry that the courthouse has to hear about it, but sometimes that's the only way that a family can get relief, is by somebody overlooking, a boss or the police or somebody overlooking, to make sure that the family isn't abused. And the victims are many. I have worked with many adults who, as children, saw their parents being beaten up. And that isn't something you can get rid of either. So it's kind of a crazy cycle that they get into.
And I think there's another end of the spiritualizing as well. If we truly believe that when we are reborn, Christ starts writing his law in our hearts, and we start being different people from the inside out, kind of opposite than what some of us were raised to think. I think that God can heal abusers as well as the abused. And I think the church would do well to look at how practical and how real we really are in terms of our approach to this. Not denying what has happened, not denying the severity, not ignoring a crisis, not putting people at risk, but calling people to a different place where their hearts are truly changed. And I think, and understand, I was raised in the 70s and the 60s. I have a lot of women's lib in my background. That being said, we as women are really good at pride and bitterness. And we don't forgive real well. And I think in response to men who have chosen to become transformed, I think that is our crisis of faith, is to go, oh my word, I'm supposed to forgive him? And so I think the church does have a role in spiritualizing in a way that is not harming the victim or the abuser, but is calling them to another place that they have never experienced before. And I think that there have to be people, I'm the lawyer here, there have to be people who know far more about that than I do, but who are qualified and willing to call them to do something new.
I think the church is relatively impotent on lots of issues. If the church were really effective, we'd have 100% people paying tithe, and I doubt there are 100% people paying tithe these days. So I think we could hear sermons, but I really think where the work has to be done is at the family level. I think in families, kids have to learn from their parents, both by modeling what's appropriate and what's inappropriate. And I think that there has to be directives. I remember talking to my son when he was small, because I have a daughter and a son. My son's the oldest of the two. And saying that you know, you're a Kaczynski, and Kaczynskis don't hit girls or women, period. Years later, my daughter said, you know, I heard Dad say that. I sometimes would provoke my brother because I knew he couldn't retaliate without getting into trouble. But, you know, I think we put too much on the church and too much on what the church can do, because I don't think the church may have the effect that a good mother or a good father has in terms of setting good examples for kids and teaching kids what they need to know. I wouldn't want to blame the church if my kids are out of line, because it really is more my responsibility to try to get them headed in the right direction. I think I'd like to mention, I got on the internet too today, actually. I found a couple good, there's a national hotline. And the national hotline gives you instructions, because it's some emergency instructions. If you think somebody's looking over your shoulder, and because you can get in trouble if you get on a hotline, your spouse finds out that you're talking to a victim's hotline, what to click on to get off. There also was another good, I wish I'd have brought it, I left it at home, but I downloaded a statement from a kind of a practical guidelines for pastors and priests and rabbis about do's and don'ts. It was very practical, East Point something center. And I looked down that list. I wished I would have brought it with me here, but it was a very practical stuff. Easily could be done in a workshop with Adventist pastors to present the material to them, so at least they would be familiar with the material of what some very practical do's and don'ts, you know, might be. But I don't think the church is entirely the answer. I really think it has to happen at a family level to be effective.
I don't think the church is the answer, but because the church is the pastor is the one that the one who's being abused often turns to. That's, you know, and I think even as church members, I can remember in my early 20s, I was approached by an older woman. She probably was in her 40s. And we had become acquainted in life's journey. And she shared with me that she was being, what she felt, abused by her husband. And I didn't know what to do. I said, you know, maybe you should go talk to the pastor. And so she did, and it just kind of fell. It never went. And she saw me years later, and she said, and I said to her, whatever happened to that? Because it just kind of, you never talked to me about it. And she said, I was told that there was really not much they could do, and he prayed with me. And I said, well, has the abuse continued? And she said, well, I've taken some actions in my home, but yeah, it's not as bad as. And, you know, I've often thought, man, I wish I could reach out to her now. In my age, I have so many more things I would do. I would, you know, be her voice. But at the time, I was ignorant and I, you know, innocent and uneducated on it.
Okay, one last question here.
When you talk about kind of what you're saying in the home and the family, what advice do you have for reformation? Kind of understanding how you can reformat the way you have maybe been brought up in a quote-unquote sick environment. You know, whether it be religiosity you see in your home of your father, or parents that are abusive or molest or whatever. How do you then reformat? Because you've grown up in a sick environment. How do you reformat and think, wow, this is not right, this is not good? How do you then go on living in a way that you can actually move in a healthy direction versus actually trying to fight against that, but then in the end actually becoming that?
That's an excellent question. Okay, then I don't need to say it. That's what I was going to say. Seek wise counsel. Counseling is extremely, extremely helpful. I would tell you, however, to seek professional counseling from someone whom you believe you can trust. Because part of the problem with the pastor, maybe if she had gone to another pastor or someone else, she may have gotten different advice. But professional counseling, what it does is seeks to not change you, but change your thoughts on how you perceive certain things, how you deal with certain things, and maybe to help you learn different coping mechanisms to follow another path, a better path, especially if the one you've been following is unhealthy or sick, as you mentioned. And what counseling seeks to do is to help to find a better path for you to take that will work with you. Because I can't tell you to walk my path because that may not work for you. But the counselor and yourself works together to determine what's a better path for you. And someone else may answer that. I wanted to touch on the question about you want to start in the home. What happens when the pastor is the one doing the abusing? If we say the church is not to, and I do understand that the church is not to be held responsible for everything, but when the leader of the church is the one abusing in his or her home, then we've got a problem. And if it's not being addressed in the church at all, then the bigger problem is that there's no role model in the home or in the church. And I believe that it starts at home. I believe it all starts at home because I can't go out. My mother would say to me, whatever you do at home is what you're going to do outside. So I believe ultimately it all starts at home, and parents need to take the responsibility for training their children. My only thought to that is when I've trained my child and I leave my child in your hands on Sabbaths, Friday nights, Sunday afternoons, Wednesday nights, and you are not telling the child the same thing I've told the child, then we have a problem. That's my only thought with that. But I wrote a paper in college years ago on the pastor abusing the wife, and who does the wife go to if the pastor of the church is the one abusing her? One, nobody's going to believe him because he's so sweet, and he says happy Sabbath to me every day, every Sabbath. Nobody's going to believe her. Who does she go to? But then if no one's listening to the pastor who is hurting, which is why he hurts or why she hurts, then where does that person go? So the system is just all screwed up, basically because of sin. I recognize that. But we have to literally start from the General Conference. I belong to an organization called the International Association of Adventist Social Workers, and we're trying to affect change in the general conference to say, listen, if it doesn't start from you guys, not many people are listening. And you mentioned have a forum where the pastors will come. Well, let me ask, the subject of domestic violence is being talked about. How many pastors are in the house? One, because mine is there. And there's another one. You see how full this room is of pastors? That's what happens when we invite pastors to talk about domestic violence. Because I think if they come and try to talk about, and my husband's only here because I dragged him here. So... But he's married to a social worker, so he knows, and he's aware that domestic violence is not right. But when I say, if we say, all right, let's have a forum in this community, and let's bring in all the Adventist pastors, and let's discuss how we can have reformation. You could hear the empty seats crying out for people to be filled. Because if we learn it, then we might have to do something. And then you think we're not getting tithed now? We really won't get tied later.
And they're the most conservative, right? So maybe they're the ones on that chart we were talking about. So,
I just have to respond to that. Pastors come and go. I'm the constant in my children's life. Okay. And that's one major difference. And one thing I always try to teach my kids, the only model we should be looking at is Christ. Not looking at other human beings, I don't think. But I really do think. I really think it stops, really starts in the home. We have a hard enough time being models for our kids the way it is. I think both Dr. Carbon and I have taught in the seminary, have taught classes in the seminary. We've worked with young pastors, youth pastors, chaplains, and tried to present to them much of this type of material. So it's not like it's being ignored, I don't think. The issue is whether it's going to be implemented. And a lot of it has to do, I once had a couple, not an Adventist couple, but a conservative evangelical couple in counseling, where the husband went right to Ephesians 5, and I went right to Matthew. And we kind of battled back and forth. It wasn't really good therapy, actually. But it was, I was trying, because my focus was on love your neighbor as yourself and treat other people as you'd like to be treated. And his focus was on submit. And so even when people read the Bible, they can find something in the Bible to support their position. And I really believe that to be healthy, psychologically and spiritually healthy, we have to have a rough balance between taking care of our needs and taking care of the needs of others. If we don't have empathy, and that's one of the biggest issues, I think, with domestic violence perpetrators. If they've not been raised in a family where they've learned how to be empathic and they don't have empathy, it's really difficult for them because they let their self-interest and their selfishness take over. And we're not perfect. None of us are perfect, and we're probably imperfectible aside of translation. But I really do believe the home needs to be a place where, and even a single parent home, a single parent can be just as powerful a parent as a set of two parents in the home. It has to be something that is dealt with at home level. Because one thing we do know with the domestic violence is there's a pattern to it. Is that if somebody grew up in a home where there was domestic violence, it will probably perpetuate itself in the next generation. So we have to break the cycle somewhere.
I think this is where I'm stumped. If the home is so screwed up because we have all this domestic violence in it, we're talking about there having to be a safe place outside of that home to go for help. And the first place most people think to go is the church. And so I think that's why we're focusing on the church, because it is the natural go-to for people. Not that the church is going to be able to magically solve all the problems, but I think we have to have a response that is thought through, that is well considered, and that is part of our culture, hopefully, in time.
I just wanted to respond to your question about, well, what do you do when you come, you know, with a background like that? And I just want to respond personally that I'm on that journey, and it's a journey.
of, you know, recovery from abusive situations and problems in your home. And it is a lifelong journey. And what I've found to be really helpful and what I would really love to see happening in Adventist churches would be to offer regular programming for church members who have personal issues. It may not be abuse, you know, and they may not be abusing their spouse, but we all have problems. And unfortunately, I've had to go outside of the Adventist Church to other Christian communities. When I was here in Berrien Springs, I was part of a small group in St. Joseph that met on a weekly basis, and we talked about these things. And that's been really helpful for me. I guess what I'm trying to say is get plugged in to a group of people who are on that journey, who are looking for change and trying to better themselves, and then just read. Anything you can find about that. Because if you're not finding it at your local church community, then you have to find it elsewhere. And it's out there. It's just unfortunate that we don't see that a lot in our Adventist churches.
Well,
I just wanted to add to what Julia was saying, and part of the whole cycle is that the perpetrator tends to alienate the abused until they have lost their friends, they lost contact with family. So, you know, being able to say, whoa, you mean I can reach out and have a place to go? And even us who are sitting here who might suspect it, reaching out to them and saying, can I be of support to you? And know that if they risk telling you, it's huge. And, you know, don't drop the ball like I did in my 20s. You know, try to take that and search for resources for them.
Well,
just one real quick thing. This is really bothering me. Everybody should know what a safety plan is, and I hope all of you do. If someone you know is in danger, go on the internet and Google safety plan. It is a list of things for someone to think through and do, and how to plan to protect yourself in case you are in a dangerous situation. And anyone who is in a home characterized by domestic violence needs a safety plan.
I didn't realize that I made a mistake. I did try to get Professor Peter Swanson, who teaches pastoral counseling at the seminary here. Unfortunately, he was out of town this weekend. I really made a mistake. I didn't realize I should have gotten all of his students, conservative and liberal alike, here. We'll try to do better next time. This is a big topic, as you have probably figured out, and has many facets, and we've only touched on a little bit today. Appreciate your questions. Let's thank Julia Pickett for a fine presentation and our panel.